Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is an Our Paranormal Afterlife remastered episode, and I'm your host, Simon Baum. I've recently gone back and listened to some of the older episodes, and I was reminded just how much valuable, relevant insight they still offer. So I'm going to be re-releasing one episode each week, now with updated and remastered audio for a much better listening experience. In this episode, I'm talking to Dr. Alan Huguenot about his book, The Death Experience. What is it like when you die? Dr. Huguenot is a physicist who had a near-death experience, after which he developed psychic powers. He studied mediumship strictly as a scientist, intending to establish scientifically that this phenomenon was valid. And now he regularly demonstrates evidential mediumship from the platform at spiritualist services and in seances. Alan, thank you very much for coming onto the podcast and being a guest.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm glad to assist.
Now, you had a near-death experience. Could you tell us how that came about?
I had a motorcycle wreck. I like to say it this way. I got killed in a motorcycle wreck, and I usually say that, being killed was the best thing that ever happened to me. The motorcycle wreck was in May of 1970, and so it's been quite a while now, about 48 years. And at that time, the official position on having that kind of experience was that you're delusional. There was no such thing as near-death experiences because Raymond Moody didn't publish his book until 1975, and that was 1970. So they wanted to tell me I was crazy and put me in the nut house. But today people want to talk to me like you do. So obviously we made a little progress. I'm no longer a nut. I'm somebody who had an experience they like to hear about. So, of course, for me, that forced me to have to study consciousness and survival and all of those things because I knew that this life is not what it's all about. This is just a chapter in an ongoing saga, is the best way to say it. So, anyway, the experience, I had a motorcycle wreck. They got me to the hospital, put me in intensive care. I was in a coma for 12 hours. They postponed surgery because I wasn't hemorrhaging. I wasn't going to die from bleeding to death. So they postponed my surgery for 4 days to make sure I'd stay conscious so they could do all the surgeries. I have a steel in my leg, and my radius of my wrist was up by my elbow someplace, and I lost all my upper teeth. I got killed in a motorcycle wreck. So going to the other side, I woke up over there basically with the light, and this being of light is the best way to say it is it's you, it's part of you. You know this person. The thing that struck me the most after I came back here was this being of light didn't identify themselves as being Krishna or Jesus or God or anything like that. It's just a being of light that I'd known for a long, long time. And I felt very home, very much back where I belonged. And then after a while with the light, I got the message that you have to go back. And I said, well, I don't want to go back. And this is pretty good. I'm going to stay here. And the light said to me, no, you have to go back. It'll just be a little while. Well, it's been 48 years, so that's the little while. And the feeling that I'm left with is I can't wait to get back there. So most people say, well, if the near-death experience is so wonderful, you can't wait to get back, why doesn't everyone commit suicide? Well, we come back with another message that we also got, which is you're not finished with what you were here to do. And until you get finished, you don't get to stay over there, which being is you're the past life podcast, that tends to say if you were to leave early, as in a suicide, you would just get recycled back here for another lifetime. Not everyone believes in past lives, and they should. because past life is reincarnation. And those of us who have had a near-death experience have literally reincarnated back into the same body. We just haven't reincarnated into a different body. So if people say, well, I believe in the near-death experience, but I don't believe in reincarnation, they're speaking what we call an oxymoron. It doesn't make any sense. If a near-death experiencer reincarnates back into the same body, then we can reincarnate into a different body just as easily. So if we were to leave this lifetime without finishing our destiny, whatever that is, which is usually hidden from most of us pretty well, we have to come back and do it again, start all over as a little baby. So it's probably easier to come back into the same body and not have to start that whole process of being someone else's kid and having them tell you, you're my child, you'll do what I say. You don't have to relearn that whole process of, oh, I'm somebody's child. And much easier to just come back into the same body. So that's how I usually say it is. The best thing that ever happened to me was I got killed and then I reincarnated back in the same body.
What was your perception like during the NDD? I thought you said that there was no 3D. So what was it like?
It was just different from what we see in 3D. I would say it's 4D, 5D. It's different dimensionally. Several things were very evident. One, and to me as a physicist, these are important things. Time was not in evidence. Time, there was sequence, but not passage of time. And time is very much E equals MC squared. Time is very much, the C square is the speed of light in that equation, that Einstein's equation. Time is very important in our space-time continuum in which we live here. But quantum physics has shown us that time is a illusion and space is an illusion. There is no separation. And so when you're there on the other side with the light, while you still have individuation, identity is I'm me and the light's the light, but I'm part of the light. And we're not separate, except I do have this identity. And that seems to agree with everything else I've studied about consciousness survival, that we survive as an individual. And was only in evidence to me between me and the light. Okay, I didn't see any other individuals while I was over there. I was a young person, 21 years old. I did have a grandmother who'd passed on, but I didn't happen to see her. A lot of people who have near-death experiences see other people that they know during the experience. I didn't happen to see any of those people. Time was not in existence. Space was not a concept the way we have it here. It was still there, and I have it on from good sources on the other side that space still exists in a way, and physical still exists in a way on that side. My own experience of it was that it was you just weren't separate. I had injuries. I was in the hospital. I was in a coma, and I had the feeling of being nurtured, of being held in like a babe in arms, being held and nurtured and healed by what I was experiencing on that side. So if I went there without having a traumatic experience making me go there, I might have had a different experience of it. So what I came back with is I know that when we're out of our body, we still exist. And I know that we exist there as a unity, even though we still individuate.
And when you returned, was it quite traumatic?
Yes, most of near-death experiencers say, and this is almost typical what they say, You know, and I've been in the International Association for Near-Death Studies for many years, and I've read literally hundreds of near-death experiences. And what they say is, suddenly I was back in my body. That's the most typical phrase. Suddenly I was back in my body. Like all of a sudden they leave the light and bang, they're back in their body. And they never describe how that happens. PHM Atwater and I both have a similar experience of having this very visceral remembrance of coming into the body. And one of the things that both of us saw, I saw candle flames and she saw sparklers, like the 4th of July, they have sparklers, little fireworks you hold in your hand and they sparkle. She saw sparklers and I saw candles. And Thoth Hermes, 6,000 years ago, said, the soul is encased in flames. And so there must have been somebody having a near-death experience there who could remember coming back in. You come in through this fire. Some of my physicist friends have said, well, that fire and the sparklers and the flames that you saw would be your expanded consciousness annihilating as you came back into this physical reality. That's a nice theory for physicists. It sort of explains it. I'm not sure what the flames are, but it came back in through flames. I remember coming into the body somewhere in the vicinity of the head and then slamming into the whole body, this wham, just, you know, slamming back in. And the feeling I had was pain, not pain from having been in a motorcycle accident, but the pain of existence, the pain of being here, of being physical, of the spirit coming back into the body and having to feel the pain. If you take your thumb and your index finger and you push them together, you're feeling your thumb and you're feeling your finger, but that's really pain. That's just a very light pain that you're feeling. If you push harder, it pretty soon it hurts. And everything we do here, even what feels like it's very soft, is pain. And that was overwhelming, the pain of coming back into this physical existence. We don't realize, because we walk around in it every day, how painful it is here. It's just existing is a pain. And when we get older, we begin to notice our knees quit working and things like that. But I'm making a joke there. But this existence is painful. So I remember that very clearly. I mean, I'm 21 years old and have no pains. And, you know, your body works pretty well. And yet here was this pain. So this life is filled with that. And I think that pain has to do with lessons, with how we learn things.
When you returned to your body, did you find that your perception, your intellect, like a kind of like your consciousness was in some way diminished? It's kind of like the physical brain was dumbing down.
Absolutely. That's what the flames annihilating. That's our consciousness, our expanded consciousness that we had on that side. Those physicists say that consciousness disappearing as you're becoming dumbed down and coming into this existence. Helen, who is a woman I talked to who's been on the other side for a quarter of a century, she often says, well, you're obstructed, you're blocked, you can't see down the pathway. She says, I'm over here and I'm in a different dimension and I can see a little farther, but not more than a couple more steps down the pathway than you can. And it's that we're Betty White, Stuart White's wife, who spoke from that side, also said that we're in the book he wrote was called The Obstructed Universe. And she's in an unobstructed universe is how Betty White says it. She can see things we can't see because we are obstructed. And so one of the things for sure that we are obstructed from knowing is that there is consciousness, survival, and past lives. Those are all blocked from us when we're in this state. When we're in that state, and like I say, when I met up with this being of light, I knew that I'd known this being for eons, for you know, this wasn't the first time we'd had a little consultation. And the being was myself. It was me being home. It was somebody I'd known for a very, very long time, much longer than this lifetime. And that felt very natural, coming back here to this life, this physical life, and reflecting back on those feelings. They then seemed to me, in our context, to be unnatural. Why did you feel that way? Well, but that is how I felt. And relying on my memory as exactly what I did feel, it felt natural to know that I'd always been. I mean, back here, you say, well, how can you prove that you've always been and that you always will be? Well, I can't prove it, but I certainly know it.
In the book, The Death Experience, What Is It Like When You Die?, you talk about the brain shift.
The brain shift. Well, when you come back, and what we've discovered, and now again, I'll go to PHM Atwater. She's very prolific in her writing. She's a little wiggy sometimes for people to read because she's not quite as scientific as she might be. She's a lot of fun, though. I really love her. But she's the one who first identified the brain shift, and it's what happens to all the near-death experiencers. And it's a way that when people, for their ego, they need a near-death experience and they didn't have one, and so they claim one. It's very easy for the rest of the NDE community to speak to them for a little while and then figure out they didn't really have one, because it changes your ego. It changes your ego a lot. And so while we still have egos, we don't have them the same way. And so this brain shift takes place in the person. They no longer care so much about money, monetary things, success things, status things. The person who's had the experience, just that doesn't matter to them anymore. Where before the experience, after we've been indoctrinated by our parents and then finally, forget about the prior lives about age 7, we move on and get involved in this existence. We're very egotistical. We want to succeed. We want to be on top. We've got I'll call it the Trump problem. That's a good one. We want to be the boss. And the near-death experience people lose that. They're no longer so striving. They know that we're all in this together. There's no getting ahead. Everybody says, well, I try hard in life because I just want to get ahead. Get ahead of what? Get ahead of whom? Get ahead of where? What do you mean get ahead? And everybody wants to get ahead. Well, that's gone for a near-death experiencer. There is no getting ahead. Most of them would just like to get back to the other side. That's the brain shift. You totally change your mind. Now, one of the things I describe, because I gained a lot of awareness. I didn't gain powers. I gained awareness of my powers. Okay, we all have the intuitive ability to do mediumship and psychic work, and we don't all know that. I came back suddenly. I could feel everyone in the room. You know, I'm very empathetic with people. I could feel, I walk into a room and there's all these people, and if I'm feeling everybody's emotions and their thoughts. And so I have to learn to close down. That was one of the hardest things, to learn to close all that off and go ahead and work I'm a naval architect, marine engineer, go ahead and design ships and use Newtonian physics and everything to do all of this, that we do here. And work in offices with people and not feel everyone. I had to close down. And so I closed down those feelings. I learned to not pay attention to them. And later, when I neared retirement, I then said, okay, now I can study mediumship and do it scientifically. And I opened those things back up again and used those. The brain shift makes you aware of these things that you already had, but that you had learned to dumb down and turn off in this lifetime. And so that's part of the shift. And when I first came back, I was like, coming into a room and psychically reading everybody in the room, it was just way too much. And first off, you can't talk about those things. Come over to somebody and say, oh, I'm so sorry your sister died. And they say, well, how did you know? So you have to learn not to do that. And so I did. But that shift is very real. And P.H. Atwater has spent a lot of time writing about the brain shift. And that's how we know if somebody had a real near-death experience or not, is if these psychological changes take place in the person. If they're still the egotistical person they were before they invented their brain, before they invented their NDE, their near-death experience, the other experiencers can generally tell that right away. It makes it difficult for someone to fake their near-death experience. And it gets done pretty often these days that it's like, it's become like having a PhD or something. It's it's the entry card that I got to bring the phone up. It's the entry card for people into the world of metaphysics. And so they, oh yeah, I had one of those experiences. I don't remember it exactly because I was only three, and they go on like that. So we have a lot of that. And the way that the other near-death experiencers test someone, if I'll put it that way, is by checking for those changes that happen in the brain shift. And so the brain shift is also, it's like they're enlightened. They've moved on. Think about the past lifetimes, and if your belief is that each lifetime is a series of lessons that we're learning, and that we progress, as Origen would say, we progress into a better position based on what we did in the prior lifetime, as our spirit grows and evolves. Having a near-death experience is like starting, it is a reincarnation. It is another lifetime. So we have this piece of growth from the prior lifetime that we've then now inherited and brought into this next lifetime. So if past lives and future lives are steps on a ladder, we moved up one step. It's another way to look at it. That's what the brain shift is. It's real changes. And these changes don't all occur in immediately. Some of these changes show up 5 years later, and things like that with the near-death experiencers. It's an ongoing process of integrating and maturing with the changes that took place. We habitually do what our culture, our family, our people do, and we follow some of those things in a habitual way. A near-death experiencer will come back and think that he still thinks like his political party, and then suddenly one day he'll bump into a phrase or a sentence or a sound bite and say, well, I don't agree with that anymore, but that's the basic part of his culture and his party that he's in. And suddenly he realizes, oh, that's no longer part of me. And that's how the maturity takes place over 5 years later and stuff like that. It's when they bump into the thing again in life after the near-death experience, their response to it is sometimes 180 degrees opposite of what it was before. And they go on through life discovering how much they've shifted, which is not necessarily evident to them when they first get back.
Did you have a life review?
I did not have a life review. I was very heavily drugged, I'll say that, on a lot of morphine. And so I didn't, most people, when they talk about the near-death experience, they go up higher up in the room, and then they go down through a dark tunnel, and at the end of the tunnel, there's a light. I just woke up with a light And I would say that when my memories resumed, we'd already gone through that life review because we were at the point of me being aware I needed to go back. And the life review has to do with, have you finished? Was it enough? The question that the light is asking most of us is, was it enough? Or what can you tell me about what you've done? Or questions like that. That's the question the light is asking. And it's not asked as a sentence. It's felt as a feeling. ESP is how you operate on that side. And so what the light's saying to you is, was it enough? Are you done? Are you finished? Did you finish your destiny? And oftentimes people will say, for my children, or I have to, you know, there's reasons they have to return to life. They're not done with the prior life. And so they come back to take care of that. And so it's, have you fulfilled your destiny, basically? And we were at that point when I realized where I was and what was going on. And I would say that probably our medical system of administering painkillers prevented me from seeing the going in process. I just woke up with a light and then remember coming back process. Most people remember the going in process and don't remember the coming back. So I didn't have that experience of the life review. So I can't tell you much about that. You'll have to, you know, you can study it, and we have a lot of books written on it in the near-death experience literature. But I would say that we had finished that process and we're in the business of deciding, well, since you're not finished, you know, since looking at your life, you haven't finished your destiny, you have to go back. And that's where I was at when I woke up over there. Coming back into this body, and I write about that in the books, the later in life, about 20 years later, actually, I happened to read the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and they have this system of colors that you see going into death. And it was remarkable to me because I had written down within the first month that I was back, I had written down the colors I saw coming back into the body. And they are the reverse colors of color sequence of the Tibetan Book of the Dead going in process. You have the red and the white that come together. You have the orange, yellow light of the experience with the light. And I saw that being covered up by tendrils of this purple and this red that were coming down. And I described it quite well there. And I had written that out 30 days after I had the near-death experience, what it was like coming back in on the colors that I saw. And here it is in Tibetan Book of the Dead in the exact reverse order as the going out process. So coming back in, we go through this process of the color changes, and those processes are all part of the thing. But the actual life review, I cannot speak on that with any authority.
And when you regained consciousness, did you tell the medical staff what had happened? How did they react?
Oh, I told everyone that, you know, and the way the medical staff reacted is this way. The nurses would say, Alan, be quiet. The doctors are coming. Okay. The nurses understood the near-death experience. They'd been around the patients when all these things happened for most of their experience. They understood all of this long before it was medical literature. So they were busy taking care of me, protecting me from the doctors. The doctors, their official position was it was a delusion. You couldn't have done that. I mean, the chief psychiatrist of the hospital, he comes to me and he says, Alan, honestly, you know, you think you're Jesus? You died and came back? You know, give me a break. Wait, that's not real. And I said, you know, I respect your education and your degrees and all of that. But here's what truth is. I've been to Mexico and you're telling me Mexico doesn't exist. You're missing an opportunity here to really get into something that's the cutting edge of truth. And just because you don't believe Mexico exists, and I'm telling you I've been there, it's kind of dumb, isn't it? And, well, that he didn't like that, of course. And he's the one who tried to put me in the nut house. He's the chief psychiatrist at that hospital. So that's what he tried to do. I challenged his authority. And anytime in the world of science, whether your name's Galileo or what it is, when you challenge the status quo, you're going to get punished for it. Science will punish you because the existing world of science has their theories. They believe in their beautiful theories. Their theory is how they put their ontology, their worldview together. And the hardest thing for anyone to change is their worldview. And so here I am challenging his worldview. Of course, his reaction is going to be, you're crazy. And they even had it in their psychiatric book, the DMV. They said, delusion. Anytime you believe this, it's a delusion. So they had under the current law at that time, every right to put me in the nut house. So what happened is my orthopedic surgeon, and because I had a head injury, I was on the head injury floor. So I was under the auspices of the chief psychiatrist, but I wasn't on the bone injury floor, okay, in this hospital. And so my doctor, my chief doctor was the orthopedic surgeon. He was the one who was in charge of me because I was mostly just broken up. But so he looked at all of this and he came running in one day. And I'd been in the hospital 33 days and I was going to be discharged in about five more. And he came running in and he grabbed my clothes, and I'm in a hospital gown, and he grabbed my clothes and he put me in a wheelchair. And I had been in traction otherwise. I mean, I was getting around now on a crutches. And he put me in a wheelchair and he put my clothes in my lap, didn't even let me put them on, and took me down the hall and out the freight elevator. The doctor pushing my wheelchair, not an orderly, not a nurse, the doctor puts me in the elevator. We go down, Dr. Rocky is his name, Harold Rocky. We go down the elevator, the freight elevator, and out the back door of the hospital. And my mother's there with the car, and we drive away. Now, the reason he did that was because they were committing me to the nut house. And he got wind of it and got me out of the hospital. He needed to pull some pins. I didn't live in Eugene, Oregon, where that hospital was. I lived in Klamath Falls. And that's where I had the accident, was in Eugene. And he needed to take some pins out of my wrist where he pulled my wrist radius back down and reattached it to the end of my arm there and put some pins in. He needed to pull those pins. So he said, in his communication, he said, okay, so you got to come back up to the hospital so we can pull your pins. And I said, well, doctor, I don't want to come to the hospital. They're going to try to put me in the nut house again. And he said, oh, don't worry about that. He said, you'll be on my floor, the orthopedic floor, and you'll just be there Monday and Tuesday, and they won't find out you're in the hospital till Friday, and you'll be gone already. So I went back to the hospital and pulled the pins. And but that was very real. They totally believed I was crazy, and they were busy squashing anyone who had a near-death experience and saying they were crazy and keeping the lid on their beautiful worldview theory of this is the way things are. And what I have to say to everyone is your worldview is just the way that you think things are and that you're comfortable with. And we really don't know much. In astronomy, we've discovered dark energy, and the Hubble telescope helped us do this. And the dark energy is 96% of the universe. We're unable to discern it. We don't know what it is. We can discern its effects, and we can calculate it, but we do not know what it is. Dark energy and dark matter are 96% of the universe. The part of the universe that we do see is 4%. And so for us to say, in our worldview, we know everything when we can only see 4% and can't even discern 96% is the worst kind of hubris. And yet that's what science and materialists and everybody want to tell us is we know everything. No, we don't. And one of the best phrases that I love, and this is Dr. Carl Sagan who says this, we just don't know. And those are the best words that I can tell you is we just don't know. And we can't deny evidence thinking that we know just because it doesn't agree with our particular scientific theory. If we're really scientists, then we realize we don't know 96% of everything. And if we're have the religion of materialism, material science, and that is a religion, it's a belief system, and as I describe belief systems, I call them BS, belief system. And whatever your belief system, whether it's a religion or a science or something else, it's your worldview, it's your belief system, it's your BS. And it's what you wish to believe. And the other people you're talking to have their own BS, and it's different from yours. None of us could possibly have the corner on truth. When astronomy and physics, we know that science only knows 4%. No one on this earth can have the corner on truth. We all don't know. So therefore, then we have to look at the evidence. We have to say, yes, you've been to Mexico. Mexico does exist. We have to do that way. We have to open our minds to see truth that's out there. And that's the big problem with religion and science. And science, mainstream science, is a religion called materialism. And they need to open up and need to open their mind and realize. And actually, it's happening. Consciousness is a big subject now in the whole world. And what Max Planck in 1900, he said, the matrix of the universe is mind. Now, science at that level, at the Max Planck level, at the quantum physics level, they all know that mind is the matrix of reality, that consciousness is what makes up the universe. And that's why Schrodinger, Heisenberg, all these people are studying Hindu metaphysics. They're trying to figure out mind. They're trying to find out, okay, so since mind is how everything happens, since quantum physics requires an observer for anything to precipitate from the wave function into a particle, since it requires an observer, mind, consciousness must be the basic fundamental quality of everything. And so that's become, we know that from quantum physics, and it's coming around. And so as that filters down, the trickle-down effect, or whatever you want to call it, from those minds at the top of the hierarchy down to the normal people, I guess we're going to learn that consciousness and consciousness survival are real things. We have a bunch of scientists who now have signed a manifesto of post-materialist science, and they're the ones that you interview and that you talk to and stuff. And they all believe that consciousness survival is a scientific fact, not a religious idea, a scientific fact. Can they explain it? No, not yet. Will they explain it? Yes. And while we laugh at materialism and say they have promissory materialism, which is that they'll find the answer later of why things are material and not conscious, and they accuse us of the same thing on our side, where promissory consciousness, where we're going to find the answer later. But that's the fact. The only thing that takes in all of the data is that consciousness is basic as a fundamental in the universe. And that takes in all the data, and it works with all the data. Materialism does not work with all the data. They have to push psychics and mediums and everybody out of the picture and say they don't exist in order for their little 3D materialism box to work. And consciousness has definitely become the forefront of scientific investigation. And all those who wish to say, metaphysical people, and metaphysics just means beyond physics. It doesn't mean religion. It means beyond physics. All of us who work in metaphysics, scientists, we're having a convention next weekend. I'll be at it. It's the Paranormal Society's having a convention in Petaluma. All of us are studying the cutting edge of where science is going, which is out into that dark energy. And anyone who says, I don't want to study that stuff, I'm throwing out all of those psychic things, is really restricting their work and their viewpoint into the old, lost, no longer works materialism. And they're going to miss the gold rush that's going on in science as we move into consciousness. And so those scientists who are holding back and being skeptics and saying, I know better, when they don't know better, are missing the boat. They're absolutely missing the boat. They're going to be standing on the dock and the ship will have sailed. And those who are into the paranormal, who are studying this, we realize that the paranormal is normal and that materialism is the one that's weird.
Well, a lot of the materialist scientists seems to believe that unproven is the same as disproven.
No, it's not. And all of our advances in science are based on some guy, some scientist, whether it's Newton or it's Galileo or it's Francis Bacon, it's somebody who's picking something up and pushing it and taking it and proving it. And that's exactly what it is. You never have anyone, you never have an advance in science when they're not somebody out on the cutting edge. And I'll go back to Max Planck again. He says that science advances one funeral at a time. You have to wait till the old guy dies off who's pushing his theory. And it's his, you know, if you've spent 40 years of your life proving that the metaphysical and the paranormal doesn't exist, you're not about to change your mind the day before you retire. You know, you're gonna keep publishing the same papers and the same books, and you're going to take your retirement, and that's that. But the new guy coming up underneath you, who was your protege, he's going to look at those new theories because he's got to find somewhere to discover something new. And all the discoveries are off the edge. They're in metaphysics. They're beyond physics. And that's where all the answers are. So it's normal. It's been that way. I saw a movie the other day with Antonio Banderas, and it was about the cave paintings in Spain, which he discovered in 1878. They didn't discover the cave paintings in France until 1902. And the character that Antonio was playing said he found these in this cave on his property. And they were, we've now shown that the paintings were 35,000 years old. But at that time, they wanted to believe in evolution. In the way that they saw it. And I'm not saying evolution is not true. I'm saying that they had a way that they saw it. And they couldn't see man evolving from apes, having been able to paint paintings on the ceiling of those caves that were as good as the paintings that we do today. They saw that man could do art all these thousands of years ago, and the gentleman who discovered it. And so because his paintings disproved their current theory, all of the scientists were against him. They all turned against him. They wouldn't even come look at his paintings in his cave. So it closed it up. He died in 1889. 11 years after he died, 1902, they discovered similar paintings in France, And all of a sudden, they wanted to come see his paintings in Spain and look at them. And they realized that these paintings, man, as we know mankind, was intelligent as he is today, with the same abilities and vision and conscious ability to think 35,000 years ago as he is today. Well, if you believe that man evolved from the apes and that was only a few thousand years ago, that kind of messes everything up. He couldn't have been that intelligent 35,000 years ago. Yeah, he could have been. He could have been that intelligent 200,000 years ago. We don't know. And again, it was a theory, the way they saw evolution and the way they decided evolution must be. And so the poor guy died and he had found a truth. That happens all the time in science.
One of the things I like about your book is that you examine other forms of evidence, such as children with past life memories.
Okay, the children with past life memories is up until about age 7, and children can't speak and articulate till they're 2, maybe 3 years old, when they can really begin to talk to you well. We have numbers of children who, in all cultures, here in the United States and in Europe, as well as in India and places where they allow this, in the countries where they allow that this could be real, like India, it's much more prevalent, because here in our own culture in the West, if our child says, well, you're not really my parents. My parents are in, you know, I had, when I was big before, I had these other parents. Mom and dad say, shut up. I don't want to hear any more of that. Don't tell me that. And if the child starts talking about his, you know, the little child starts saying, well, when my wife that I had before, you know, the parent's just going to say, that's not true. Shut up. Okay. But now that we're into consciousness and studying this, more and more people in the Western culture are bringing it out that their children remember past lives. And we have one of the really fun ones is in Sweden. There's a girl, I'm trying to remember her name, but she remembers being Anne Frank. And most people know who Anne Frank is in Holland. Well, her parents didn't know who Anne Frank was. And this girl was born in the late 50s, and Anne Frank died in 44, I think. And she remembers being Anne Frank. And so that's a pretty popular one. She's kind of fun to hear her talk because she has quite a story. But the thing with the children who remember past lives is Ian Stevenson at the University of Virginia, the Carlson, the guy who created Xerox, gave a bunch of money to his department if he would go study children who remember past lives. So he began doing this in the early 1960s. And so he studied over 2,500 cases around the world, flew there. When a child remember a past life, he would go check out all the facts. Used to live in this other town, used to live in that house, you know, and the child would tell all these things, and then they go investigate. And they found the past lives to be real. The children were remembering real things. In many cases, you'd have a 9-year-old girl who remembered, not at 9 when she finally met the other family, but she'd remembered earlier on. She could speak a different dialect in India. She could, she remembered what the house looked like, where it was. When she met her former husband, she knew the pet names to talk to him. He believed that she, the young girl, was his wife again, you know, from the prior life. All that kind of stuff. Stevenson had investigated all these things. And then he died in 2007, and Bruce Grayson took over as the head of that department. And now Jim Tucker is the head of that department at the University of Virginia. And it's they still study this stuff, and they have thousands of these cases. In many cases, when the child remembers a past life, Stevenson also would take pictures. If the child died by getting a bullet wound, they might have a mark on their body at the same place where they got the bullet wound in the prior life. He took a lot of pictures of these physical evidence in the new child of what had happened in the past life, where they're deformed or they have And they remembered this prior life. And then they've investigated the prior life. The Tlingit Indians in the Pacific Northwest on the coast, they're not the Haida out on the islands, but the Tlingit that live on the coast, have a very definite belief in reincarnation of from past lives. They believe they come back in their own family. And so they'll, when they're about to die, they'll say, I'm going to come back as your son, or, this is the uncle dying. He's saying, I'm going to come back as your son. The son comes back, he's born, nobody tells him. The son starts saying, well, remember when I was your uncle? I mean, this stuff where it's allowed, where we allow it to be a possibility, is very real for these people, and they have lots of evidence for it. So anyway, they've studied thousands of these cases, and I love the one that happened in Paraguay, and her name was Marta. And Marta, the story is that the first woman fell in love with a guy, and her father wouldn't let her marry the guy. So the guy committed suicide. So she deliberately contracted tuberculosis so she could die. And before she died, she told her friend, I will come back as your daughter. And she died. 10 months later, the friend had a daughter. And the parents had decided, because they were scientific people, had decided to treat it with single blind conditions. They never told the daughter anything. She only lived 12 miles from where she used to live in the past life. They told her nothing. She'd keep saying, I want to go back to my family. She'd say all kinds of things as she grew up. And they wrote them all down, and they kept it in single blind conditions until she was 12 years old. And then they finally took her to visit the former family. The last time that Ian Stevenson visited with her was in 1972, and she was 54 years old then, the girl who remembered that childhood. She still remembered it at age 54. Most children begin to forget after age 7 their experiences this way. But those past life experiences prove that we reincarnate. They're very, we have lots and lots of evidence, tons of very good evidence, where children remember a dialect and can speak it. One where I'm trying to remember her name. I can't remember her name right now, but she's coming up on the railroad, to the railroad platform, to the town where she says she was from. She's never been there before. She sees her aunt and her uncle from the prior life standing on the platform, and says their names from the train. She gets off the train, she runs to them and starts talking in their dialect. And she's never been here before. These are pretty spectacular things that Ian Stevenson has written about. And if you haven't read his books, get his books and read these stories that I'm talking about. They will really, they won't convince a skeptic, because you can't convince a skeptic, but they will provide reassurance for those of us who aren't skeptical about this.
Reincarnation was part of Christianity, wasn't it, before it was removed?
Absolutely. The Christian bishop Origen, in the year 200 AD at Alexandria, and Clement, who was the bishop before him, write extensively on reincarnation as part of Christianity. And it was Justinian, the emperor, not the pope, Justinian, who called the council in 553 AD, the second ecumenical council at Constantinople, but the fifth ecumenical council in 553 AD. He called that thing, and Avilius, the Pope, wouldn't even attend it, and he was in Constantinople, but he wouldn't attend because he said it's a travesty. The bishops wouldn't even give the emperor what he wanted, which was to approve what's called the anathema against Origen, which basically said you can't believe in reincarnation. They never approved it. It's not in the minutes of the Ecumenical Council. They never approved this thing that Justinian wanted. But Justinian left the council telling everyone that he'd got it passed and approved. And basically it said that if you believe in reincarnation, you're a heretic. The bishops never passed that. Justinian used it to go around using the Roman armies to kill everybody that believed in reincarnation. So, you know, it's sort of advancing the Catholic Church's received position using the sword. And that's what, so for after 553 AD, and you can read about all this, you can study all this. You're not going to hear it from the Pope, but you can study all this. It's the truth. It's all part of history. And so they got rid of believing in reincarnation at that point. Now, in the what we today call Turkey, the Turkish Peninsula, the Christian Church had a different viewpoint. The Patriarch of Constantinople didn't believe in reincarnation, but the rest of the church did. And there was a lot of controversy and a lot of rivalry between Alexandria in Egypt, Constantinople, Istanbul in Turkey, and Rome. Who's going to be the head of the church? And because the Roman bishop had the government of Rome for the Roman Empire right there and was under the thumb of the Emperor Justinian or whoever, that bishopry became the head of the Roman Catholic Church. And the Roman Catholics kept going around and telling the people in Constantinople or at Alexandria how they were supposed to believe. It was Roman Christians who burned the library several times, burned the library at Alexandria, and tried to break up the university there. The University of Alexandria understood the precession of the equinox, which is the wobble that's in our Earth. Our Earth is on an axis, and it wobbles in about 24,000 years. It wobbles like a if you have a child's top, a little toy that they play with, it'll wobble on top before it falls over. Well, the Earth wobbles on its axis in 24,000 years, and they had discovered that. The University of Alexandria knew the diameter and the circumference of the Earth, and that it wobbled on its axis, and the Christians from Rome came there and burned all that stuff. Then the Alexandrians were happy to have it as part of their knowledge. So that ushers in the Dark Ages, and they teach people not to read and just listen to the priest. And so you have 1,100 years of what we call the Dark Ages in Western history, created by the Catholic Church by getting rid of everything that we knew. And I often say, I wonder what we knew or that they knew in Egypt, in the library at Alexandria, that we haven't yet rediscovered. Because we didn't discover the precession of the equinox till the 1700s. And that was only after the Renaissance began with the Medicis in Florence, when they began to work in opposition to the church. And that's what brought about the advance of Western culture, is the Renaissance. It's when we finally decided we would study the things that we had known 1,100 years earlier. So, yes, Christianity believed in reincarnation, very much so. And so you read Clement or you read Origen, O-R-I-G-E-N, Origen. He's the Christian bishop at Alexandria in 200 AD. And he's very clear, and he's the first theologian in the Christian church to sit down and create a systematic viewpoint of what Christianity is and is about. And so he's the, for the next 300 years, he's pretty well liked in a lot of the Christian community. And some of those groups that agreed with him survived even till 800 AD. And then, you know, they were kind of separate groups, you know, illegal groups, if you want to say that. But anytime, I have to say this, anytime you have organized religion, it's a sin.
We've just about run out of time. You've been such a great guest and you've given us so much information. Could you just let us know about your books and where we can find them?
You can find my books on Amazon. They're available there. The way it works, I work with Dog Ear Publishing. They just publish the book and mail it to you. You know, you order one, they print it and put it in the mail that day. It's a really good system. We don't have any books sitting in stock that are already printed you know, we don't waste that. If you buy a book, they'll print it, send it to you. They're very good books. They're also available in electronics. If you want to have them in your iPhone, you can do that. I'm not out to sell the books. I'm out to get the information out to people. I just write the books so that people can have the information. I don't make my living selling books. They're very, in the new one, the Science of Consciousness, I don't give the skeptics very much room. Everyone, I just sort of take out every one of their arguments one at a time. And what I do there in consciousness, I explain the basis of materialism was based on six basic principles. And those principles are all presuppositions. A presupposition like reality. We think reality is real. And I take those apart for you very nicely using quantum physics. And I show you how there are these presuppositions have all been disproven, like locality. You all may all have heard of non-locality. Non-locality disproves locality. It proves that space is an illusion. Hard for us to take in as people, but it's true. Anyway, those books are out there. You can find them on Amazon. That's the easiest thing to do.
And do you have a website?
I do have a website. It's afterlife.pro. It's not .com. It's .pro, afterlife.pro. And that's my website. And I don't spend a lot of time on the website, a little bit now and then. And lately, people have been asking me, can we get readings from you? And I finally decided, okay, I do readings at spiritualist churches all the time from the platform. And I really don't want to do readings to make a living doing readings. But I will let people hire me to do a reading because they all demand it from me. Can I get a reading? Can I get a reading? So I'm fine. Okay, you can have a reading. And once or twice a week, somebody wants a reading. So I give them a reading. I do that too. What I do there is I get names from the other side. And that always amazes people. I say, well, I've got your father, Ralph, here. And they say, wow, you know, you got his name. Yeah, name pretty easy to get. You just tell the spirit they have to tell you their name or you won't take the message. And other mediums say, oh, I can't, it's hard to get names. No, it's not. You just tell anyone who wants to come through, they have to tell you the name and their relationship. And so I get a lot of evidence that way. Well, that's always fun too.
Thanks a lot for coming on and being such a great guest. It's very kind of you to give us your time.
You're welcome. Always happy to work with anyone that is trying to prove consciousness.
And that was an interview with Dr. Alan Huguenot about his book, The Death Experience, What Is It Like When You Die? And my book, titled Verified Near-Death Experiences, is out on Amazon. You can get it on paperback, audiobook, or Kindle. And if you enjoy this episode, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.